If there was a competition to decide which of the mountain ranges of Wales was the most mystical, the Preseli's would win. Shaw's Dragon Eggs are always free range. Running almost to the claw tips of the Pembrokeshire coast in southwest Wales, the magic mountains of Preseli are to be found hanging inland like a haze, as the writer Gwyn Jones put it. Mind you, calling them mountains is a bit of a stretch in the first place. More a sweep of wind-blasted uplands, where the land seldom rises over 180 metres above sea level, and not a single peak reaches as high as 600 metres, or 2,000 feet, which is the definition of a mountain. Yet the highest of these hills, Foel Cwm Cerwyn, stands tall and sentinel enough to have guided the sailors of West Wales safely to shore, and on a clear day, one of those Mediterranean blue skies which seem to light up the land, you can see not only the patterned field tapestries of Pembrokeshire, shot through with the gold threads of gorse hedges, but also as many as 9 other Welsh counties. This certainly gives the sense of being on a mountain, especially when you look west and see the charcoal line of the Irish coast across the water. Such days of translucent blue skies are pretty elusive hereabouts, where the weather is more often sodden, the artillery of Atlantic rain pelting down on the roof, or on slightly more benign days, a more delicate pitter-patter, as if the jazz percussionist Buddy Rich is up there on the roof slates, drumming there with soft brushes, beating out a tune called Dripping, Always Dripping. But on a good day, when shafts of sunlight strafe the land and gorse bushes flare sulphur with flower and give off that faintly ridiculous smell of coconut, you'll get that exhilaration that sometimes only comes when you walk under a sky bountiful with larks, sorceling into the blue beyond, creating bright skylark cantatas as other birds join in. Walk among the crimped and crenellated edges of these hills, and you might feel as if you're treading a land which has a mystery running underneath it, like wild Welsh springs or spring freshets, ready to bubble free with a breath of fairy spirit. Sound like exaggeration? A touch of the Celtic whimsies? Not so. Let me tell you about a day I walked up toward the famous blue stones of the Preseli Range. I was in the company of the beauty editor of a very fashionable magazine, and we were both brimming with enthusiasm for the place. It does quietly affect you, especially when the grey rocks are draped with low fog, as they were on that day, and hard rock softens into marshmallow and dove-feather greyness. The mist got thicker, settled into a sort of wet oilcloth, draped over the land, and our walking became a tad uncertain. We were now stumbling forward, our toe-holes tentative and slippery in places, as we felt our way along through the thickness of our boot-soles. Then, out of the mist, appeared a woman who immediately asked me when my birthday was, I kid you not, and when I said it was just before Christmas, I expected her to announce something about my being a Capricorn, born under the sign of the goat, which could only be useful for 2 lost souls teetering over loose scree and stones as if we were wearing stilettos. Without further ado, the woman announced that I was the one who would lead this country out of darkness. And with the final certainty of those words, she disappeared, as if absorbed into the wet sponge of the day. Now you'd have expected us to be a bit flabbergasted, but because we were in this wild place, where the dividing line between this world and another is thinner, we accepted this as being no different to the appearance of a bird such as the wheatear, signalling its appearance with a semaphore of white rump before flitting into the fog. Of course a strange woman made an appearance and then disappeared without so much as a by your leave. This was the Preseli's, after all. And besides, Wales has a long history of y Mab Darogan, the prophetic son who would one day step up to the plate. Although here, I suspect, it was a case of mistaken appearance. For some, the Preseli Mountains are synonymous with one man, the poet Waldo Williams, who is arguably the best Welsh-language poet of the 20th century. This was both his habitat and spiritual home. In one of Waldo Williams's greatest poems, he said this, Dyma'r mynyddoedd, ni fedr ond un iaith I codi, a'i rhoi yn ei rhyddid yn erbyn wybren cân. Here are the mountains. Only one language can raise them, and set them in all their freedom against a sky of song. He might have heard the same exultations of larks singing skywards. As a pacifist, it was natural that one of Waldo Williams's burning concerns was the militarisation of his native Pembrokeshire, which led to his becoming a conscientious objector and resigning as headmaster of the small rural school at Punchiston. A poem he wrote at the time on Punchiston Moor links the poor lands and sparse communities of the Pembrokeshire he loved so well to a wider Wales, a country of cairn and dark moorland, nursery of independence and judgment. Above the rubble, your strength will stand from age to age. Draw us to you, make us a part of your life and ways. There's some very famous rubble which was carried away from these mountains, as they're the source of the bluestones which found their way to Stonehenge, that imposing set of standing giants, stone magnets which attract thousands of new agers each year, along with enthusiasts for the Neolithic and camera-laden tourists. The most famous ring of standing stones in Britain was erected using material from the Preseli Range, a journey of over 200 kilometres from Pembrokeshire to the flatlands of Salisbury Plain, and begat a mystery that has both puzzled and engaged people ever since. One of the earliest accounts of these stones is found in Geoffrey Monmouth's fanciful history of the kings of Britain. He tells us about a successful campaign by Uther Pendragon and his 15,000 men in Ireland, where, with a little bit of wizard magic from Merlin, they managed to dismantle the stones of a henge in a place called Killara Hill, which were then exported and finally raised in Wiltshire. A geologist called the Reverend Daniel Conybeare swallowed this account hook, line and sinker, especially as he very much believed in the biblical flood as an actual fact. But how did the stones travel there? Speculation followed hypothesis, followed daft conjecture, with a spate of books suggesting a panoply of possibilities. The stones were moved overland in relay from one small community to the next, or they were moved overland and then by sea. But even a cursory look at a map would show the difficulties, the marshlands, the river banks and valleys, not to mention the great blanket of wildwoods that stood in their way if the path took them inland. It is far more likely that the great movements of the Ice Age 450,000 years ago carried the stones with them, treating the great tonnages of rock like so many trinkets, carrying them onwards with an icy will. A little under a decade ago, scientists found an unexpected quality to the stones scattered over the Preseli uplands. If you hit some of them with a small hammer made of stone, as many as one in five gave off metallic sounds, not unlike gongs or tubular bells or tin drums, and of course the same quality is true for the stones of Stonehenge, suggesting the tantalising possibility that the stones were picked for their musical, ritual value, stones that could literally sing, or produce some very, very early rock music. Many people have therefore generated their own versions of the story of how the blue stones travelled to Stonehenge, turning geology into legend. But there's also a legendary character intimately connected with these mountainous hills. In the Mabinogion, the finest repository of Welsh folk tales, we find the story of Culhwch and Olwen, in which King Arthur undertakes to help his cousin complete a list of seemingly impossible tasks, including retrieving some objects such as a comb and scissors hidden between the ears of a gigantic wild boar called a turchtruith. Arthur and his men chased him all over these hills, and there are lots of place names which commemorate this frantic hunt, when the enormous animal would often stop, slay some of Arthur's knights, then pound away again. My destination on this day was a ring of stones called Cerrig y Marchogion, which commemorates the slaying of some of Arthur's knights. The land here is wind-blasted, the moor grasses bleached, and the absence of trees is notable. Today it's empty sky overhead, apart from some drifting buzzards which circle lazily on the thermals, mewing plaintively, the perfect soundtrack to a trek across blasted heath and wind-scorched moorland. The few trees that survive among the jagged dentitions of the cairns and outcrops have been turned into bonsai versions by the wind, rowans miniaturised by the endless flow of the southwesterlies, hawthorns laid low by the whips of wind. But in the winter, things can really change, and there have been roosts of an estimated 2 million starlings, yes, 2 million starlings, in places such as Manachlog Ddu in the Preseli's. This is a natural history spectacle to rival that of African big game, as the wheeling, twisting birds pixelate the skies, like dark clouds which twist and veer, compact and expand in mesmeric displays of aerial ballet. The collective noun for starlings is murmuration, and that is only one approximation of the sound they make, as huge congregations of birds displace air and chatter excitedly at the prospect of settling into the roost. They can sound like a swarm of Pembrokeshire locusts out to denude the bracken of all its fronds. Scientific studies of these flocks show that each bird takes its coordinates from exactly 7 other birds, much as aircraft display teams keep the wing tips of their jets equidistant from each other. In this way, starlings make it very hard for any predator, a little Merlin falcon, say, or a scything peregrine, to detach one individual from the flock. To them, a starling is little more than a flying, feathery volivant, but starlings know all about the idea of there being safety in numbers. But today, as I reach the little circle of standing stones, there is only one bird present, a nervous meadow pipit, which pipes its call as it disappears over a ridge. The stones are smaller than I'd imagined, but it's a good place to pause and take in the view. How things change, and how things might have been so different if I'd taken the old lady's advice as a job description and tried to lead my country out of darkness. Too old now. I also ponder our need for myth, to believe in an Arthur or a gigantic wild boar or a huge set of stones that might have been taken overland in Neolithic times long before the invention of machinery. A French writer might have explained it all when he suggested that myth is, after all, only very old gossip. Vivid gossip that comes down to us through many a long century. Overhead, the buzzards turn in lazy concentric rings. In the summer heat, the standing stones seem to shiver.